Lock the gate!
All right, let's do this. How are you, what the fuckers, what the fuck buddies, what the fucksters, what the fuckaroos, what the fuckaroo bonsais, maybe, even. How are you? Hi, Mark Maron here. Welcome to the show. Thank you for joining. I'm happy to be here. I'm punchy. I'm tired. I shot all day. Maron season 4 in progress. It's happening. First 2 episodes were tremendous. Did I already tell you about that? No, I couldn't have. We just wrapped it on Monday night. Lynn Shelton, who you've heard on this show and seen her many movies, directed the first 2. Spectacular. Went great. I think I was in the middle of it the last time I talked to you. The stories are good now. This block, we're shooting with the incomparable Bobcat Goldthwait back on set with his hats and his interesting clothing choices and his auteur vision. And we're doing the thing. We're doing the show. I'm bearded and frazzled, and it's going well. I think you'll like them. It's fun for me. I think I mentioned this before. The fact that we're in a new area, a reality not like the one that I live necessarily, has freed me up a bit. I'm having a bit more fun. Hope that's okay. My guest today is the Honorable Peter Guralnick. Peter Guralnick, I don't know if you know who he is, but he's one of the great music writers. He's written amazing books about music. The one that first blew me away was Searching for Robert Johnson. He went on to write Last Train to Memphis, The Rise of Elvis Presley, Careless Love, The Unmaking of Elvis Presley. He did Dream Boogie, The Triumph of Sam Cooke, which I read a little bit of. I've read a little bit of all these books, but his newest book is Sam Phillips, The Man Who Invented Rock and Roll, and I got to talk to him. Now, I am certainly no music nerd. I know what I know, but I don't know it in detail, and I don't run too deep with some things. A few specific things, maybe I know some stuff about. It's not a nerd out on one specific artist or many specific artists, but this guy's a historian, and the people he chooses to talk about are pretty fascinating people. This is a massive book on Sam Phillips. And Sam Phillips, Sun Record Studios, I mean, they were all there, man. This is where it all happened. This is where it all coalesced. Black music, country music, mountain music, some gospel music, and it all sort of came together. And that's where Johnny Cash and Elvis Presley and Jerry Lee Lewis and Howlin' Wolf, a lot of them all came out of there. And some country artists that I didn't even know about. Charlie Rich, John Prine did a Sun single back in the day. Carl Perkins, of course. Out of the vortex of all those different forms of music and personalities comes rock and roll. Perhaps maybe, depending on what you think the first rock and roll song is, I believe I discussed that with Peter Guralnick. I did go to Sun Records. I stood out in front of it. Unfortunately, the time that I went there when I was younger, I don't think I was as into it as I should have been. I did go. I went to Nashville. I went to Memphis. I did go to Graceland. I did go out there. Did not know Elvis, met his uncle. I met his uncle Vernon, and I bought a Graceland comb that was taken from me by a woman who drove a large Cadillac with leopard skin pattern seat covers. Where does that go? How does that work out? Well, I went out to Graceland, and I saw the house. And I was surprised at how relatively humble it was and not too ostentatious. Perhaps it was for the time. There's a room with 3 TVs, and that was sort of like a room with 3 TVs. This guy was out of control. I do remember the trophy hut out back. That was really the most impressive. There's an entire sort of hangar just for gold records and stuff. So that was interesting. And who was that comic? Who used to do that great joke? God, what was that guy's name? Did that great joke. If Elvis was so great, why is he buried in his backyard like a gerbil or hamster or something? Oh, if anyone knows who did that joke, please tell me. That was a good joke. Well, I think it's Rob Schneider, but I don't think it was. So across the street, my memory from Graceland was this strip mall where you'd buy all kinds of things Elvis. And Vernon Presley sat there in front of one of those stores saying he was Elvis's uncle and he'd written this book. Just sitting out there in front of a store on his own selling this book about Elvis, Vernon Presley. So I bought a book and I bought a comb and I bought some other knickknacks, Elvis knickknacks. That night back in Memphis, well, what had happened was, this is a rock and roll story. It's got nothing to do with rock and roll. It's got nothing to do with Elvis. Maybe it does. But that night I had met some dudes on the roof. They'd sold me a little blow. So I had a little blow. I had some Elvis paraphernalia. I had Uncle Vernon's book. I had nothing to do and I was all alone and I was drinking. So I did a little blow and I went to a club. I asked someone, maybe the concierge at the Peabody, where could I go to do some clubbing? Because I was on a little blow and ready to go in Memphis, Tennessee. So I went to this place that he recommended. And in my memory, I walk into this large kind of one-room club and there was nobody in it but one crazy-looking woman dancing in the middle all by herself. Just dancing, looking crazy. And I don't mean that in a derogatory way. It all looked a little crazy. It looked like I just walked into a David Lynch situation. And I didn't know what else to do. I was drinking. I was doing some blow. This was the club I was at. So I went out and, you know, started kind of, you know, not dancing with the lady. I waited till she got off the dance floor. And I said, what's up? She goes, not much. I go, you want to do some blow? She goes, yeah. So we do some blow. I go, you want to hang out? Or something, whatever the equivalent of that was then. She goes, okay. And we go out. I say, I'm staying at this hotel. I don't have a car. She goes, I have a car. We jumped into the large Cadillac Eldorado with leopard skin seats. It looked like a pretty well-worn in car. And we drove back to the Peabody. We went up to my room. And we did some blow. And nothing happened. But she did, for some reason, she goes, can I have this Elvis comb? And I go, yeah, I guess. And she took my Elvis comb and some of my change and maybe some matches. I think I gave her a lighter and the rest of my cigarettes. And then she left. So that was not very rock and roll. I guess that's the point of that story. But nonetheless, in terms of Elvis Presley, it's weird. I knew some of his great songs when I was younger, but it took me seeing Rick Danko open for Jerry Garcia at the Orpheum in Boston, do Mystery Train, alone on an acoustic guitar, in the most beautiful, intense, almost tripped out fashion. Granted, I was on a little mushrooms, but that was my portal in to everything Elvis, somehow or another, was seeing the late Rick Danko just lose himself in Mystery Train. Anyway, that was quite a ramble. I hope it tightened up and made some sense or was at least compelling as we enter this conversation with rock journalist Peter Garrard. Every now and then, there's a decision that's a no-brainer, and I can tell you from experience, it was a no-brainer to use Stamps.com when we started using it 11 years ago. Crazy. 11 years ago. Now, more than a decade later, Stamps.com is better than ever. The Stamps.com mobile app is like having a post office in your pocket wherever you are. You can take care of things on the go, like mailing checks, sending invoices, legal documents, and more. Easily schedule package pickups through your Stamps.com dashboard. And when you need to take care of shipping, all you need is a computer and printer. Stamps.com even sends you a free scale. Make the same no-brainer decision that over 1 million other businesses have with Stamps.com. Sign up with the promo code WTF for a special offer that includes a 4-week trial plus free postage and a free digital scale. No long-term commitments or contracts. Just go to Stamps.com, click on the microphone at the top of the page, and enter code WTF. Nick. All right, let's focus on rock and roll, man.
All right, what's that?
Yeah, you know what it is. You've been chasing it your whole life. So you're like a real writer guy, Peter Guralnick. I've been seeing your name forever, and I own several of your books. This one, the new one I got for free, but I read most of Dream Boogie. I've had I Like Going Home, Feel Like Going Home Forever. Searching for Robert Johnson was a nice poetic meditation. Yeah. On the nature and truth of Robert Johnson. The double Elvis slammer, two major books that ate up how much of your life? A decade at least?
Yeah, only 11 years.
Last Train to Memphis and Careless Love, the quintessential seminal Elvis tomes.
Well, you know, whatever. Yeah,
whatever. What do you tell? You know. But the thing, so, but did you set out originally? I mean, I think you're, you know, I think we went to the same college. I don't do a lot of research.
Where'd you go to school?
I graduated from Boston University.
Yeah, no, I graduated from Boston University, and I even taught at Boston University in the classics department when I was 23, 24, 25.
Classics.
Classics. You know, I'm a classic kind of guy.
But okay, so let's talk about that for a minute. So what does that mean, classics?
Latin and Greek.
So you can read Latin and Greek?
You know, I taught Greek, but I was faking it. I majored in Greek. I never was that good at it. Latin I was quite good at, and I could read pretty well. But I taught a course in the ancient novel where one year it would be in reading Latin of Apuleius or Petronius. Yeah. Another year it would be in English. But we read stuff like Last Exit to Brooklyn. I introduced Last Exit to Brooklyn.
Selby.
V, Tristram Shandy, a whole range of things, which I saw as being parallel in various ways to these ancient works.
To the tragedies. And to the narratives.
To the narratives, yeah. To this kind of...
The great hermeneutic code where everybody ends kind of shitty or ends kind of good. Right?
Or ends.
Everybody ends.
right.
So when you were a kid, you were, you know, kind of a language nerd?
No, not at all. It was an easy thing to major in because in high school, I got so much Latin that I could declare a major and take no courses.
Right.
And then I could take whatever I wanted. But no, all I ever wanted to be was a writer and a baseball player from the time I was 6 or 7 years old.
But a writer, because you did a couple of books out of the gate there that weren't necessarily along the journey that you took, right?
No, I've written 10 novels. I mean, I wrote my first one when I was 19.
Here comes the truth.
And,
here comes
no, I didn't set out to write. The only reason, and I published two collections.
Don't break my heart, Peter. You're the guy. Don't tell me that music writing was just something you had to do for money.
There was no money. I mean, I would never have done it. You know, if money were the object, this is not what I would have done. But I published two collections of short stories when I was 20 and 21. But I wrote about music. I wanted to be a writer, but I fell into the blues when I was 15 or 16.
How'd that happen?
Well,
because that's when I got it too. I mean, you're older than me, right? How old are you?
Me, I'm about 15.
Come on, 15 at heart.
15 at heart. I mean, the person on the exterior that you see is not the real me. Yeah. No, I'm 71.
Okay. All right, so I'm 52. But so I guess then you were getting the blues. As it was first sort of popularly introduced to rock fans.
Well, before that, really.
Oh, yeah?
Yeah, I mean, it was just the brother of a friend of mine went to the Newport Folk Festival. He comes back with about, you know, with a couple of dozen albums, and they could have been...
That they were selling at the folk festival?
Yeah, and they could have been, you know, I just can't think of who would... it would be Peter, Paul, and Mary, except that was before Peter, Paul, and Mary. But just all kinds of folk, Joan Baez was before.
Couple blues guys.
And he came back with a couple of blues
like
records.
What, Skip James?
No, he wasn't.
Muddy Waters?
Well, I'd say more like Big Bill Brunzi.
Oh, okay.
Ronnie McGee and Sonny Terry. Anyway, this friend of mine and I just settled on, and we heard these blues things, and we just went crazy. And we got, this was like 1959, 1960, and we... Just it became a lifelong search, and it just turned me around. It turned my life around, and it led me to every other kind of music that I listened to. Every
sure.
kind.
But what do you think it is, though? You're a Jewish guy?
I'm a Jewish guy.
Yeah, me too. So, and I'm not saying anything. I do talk about that sometimes. But, you know, there's been a few fairly inspired Jewish blues players and a lot of Jewish kids like myself who were mildly enlightened when we were younger and gravitated towards blues. Did you ever think about that connection at all? There's no...
No,
never,
because I had no Jewish background. I'm Jewish ethnically. I know I'll be on the list when Donald Trump draws it up. But, you know, other than that, that's my identity.
Yeah. Well, I feel kind of the same way. I had a little bit of Jewish background. I mean, I did, you know, I did seek sort of identification through Jewishness at some point. I'm not a religious man, but culturally I'm Jewish.
Yeah, no, I didn't have any of that. But I know Ralph Bass, for instance, who was at Chess Records. You know, he made this big connection between Jews and the blues and what he heard from the cantors growing up in the temples. It was exactly the same as the blues. Huh. And I take that, you know, for his truth, and I don't dispute that, but that was not the case with me. No, it was something like, I had never heard anything like this before, and it presented a raw slice of reality. I mean, it was like Last Exit to Brooklyn, in a sense.
Oh, yeah, I could see that.
It was just
yeah.
a whole, introduced a whole element and a sound and an unadorned honesty that just knocked me out.
And musically and vocally.
Musically and vocally, both. And I just sat in my room. My mother had gotten this phonograph record with green stamps from Stop
yeah.
and Shop.
Yeah.
And, you know, it's one of these little portable things
sure.
that everything's built
with
in.
With the lid, you close it
yeah,
and open
yeah.
it. Yeah.
And I would sit there in my room, first at home, then when I went off to college, just listening to these records and studying them and trying to decipher them. I'd go to Roxbury and, you know, go to these bars and stuff. I couldn't order a drink. I'd get bloated on ginger ale.
So the circuit, the black neighborhood in Roxbury, Mattapan was pretty black at that time too, right?
Yeah, I mean, the jazz clubs were along Mass Ave as you headed down to Columbus, and there would be battles of the blues and stuff.
But this is in the early 60s?
Yeah, but the big revelation in my life when mm-hmm. it came to that, and I want to answer the question about why I started writing about music, but was when the soul shows started to come to town. And that was around 64 when WILD, which was the first black station
yeah.
in Boston, opened up. And Early Bird was there. And
he was a DJ?
He was a DJ. He ruled Boston. And he moved to Renton, Washington some time ago. And I've stayed in touch with him
Renton
all my
is.
Life. Yeah, well, so
my second wife came from, her parents were right outside of Renton.
Well, for some reason, Early Bird thought the future was in Renton, which didn't turn out to be the case.
That did not turn out to be the case unless he wanted a job at Boeing at the time.
No, I think he had EMP in mind for some reason.
Uh-huh.
And that didn't, he sort of fronted a couple of shows, but that was about it. But
these soul shows, who were those touring acts?
Well,
what did you go see?
The first show I saw was the Summer Shower of Stars in 1964.
Yeah.
And it was Solomon Burke, Joe Tex, Otis Redding,
oh.
Sugar Pie DeSanto, The Tams, one of those Philadelphia great, Garrett Mims, Garnett Mims. It was incredible. I ran into a girl that I had known before I'd grown up with.
Yeah.
She was going out with a low-level mafia guy who had something to do with the putting on the shows.
Uh-huh.
She says to me, how would you like to usher the show?
Uh-huh.
And I said, I mean, I jumped at it. I scared.
But these are all black audiences, I'm assuming.
They were all black audiences, yeah.
And you were just this little wiry kid who was sitting there taking it in.
Yeah, I was sitting there like this.
Yeah.
You know, the audience can picture how
I can picture. I'm going to just project an entire life onto you by who you are right now.
Well, then I started ushering the shows.
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, and
so
it's,
free ticket.
I might have gotten $10 or $15. I'm not sure. I was the worst usher in history. I mean, because the head usher would say, ushers, to the balcony. They're breaking in off the fire escape. And everybody would be heading to the balcony, and I'd be heading to the bathroom or something, you know.
Not going to get involved.
Or showing people, you know, showing this nice couple to their seats and having these two hired guys with their arms crossed saying, what are you going to do about it? Yeah. Oh, I'm going to go get the head usher.
Yeah, I'm going to go find somebody to help.
But I'd get backstage, and I'd see Jackie Wilson backstage.
Yeah.
I mean, there was no connection other than observing. And I would, Little Richard would be playing piano before the show.
Right, you felt the heat and the excitement of show business and, these guys who were able to put out that type of sound and that type of
music. Well, and it taught me that the blues was a living thing. I mean, I knew the blues was a living thing, but it didn't exist in my life. I'd see Lightnin' Hopkins was the first blues
singer.
So you
see the sound moving through the generations of music.
Well, yeah. I mean, I didn't make a distinction. I went to see...
It was just black music, in a way.
Yeah, and eventually Waylon Jennings. I mean, it led me to Waylon. But, for instance, I saw the Staple Singers...
All ends with Waylon.
I saw the Staple Singers going up against the Mighty, Mighty Clouds of Joy.
Uh-huh.
And I thought, man, the Mighty Clouds of Joy are just going to destroy them. And I saw Mavis just command this, again, with an all-black audience,
mm-hmm.
just pulverize the audience with the power of her voice. So it was that kind of thing.
So this stuff just moved you to the point where you couldn't make sense of it with your brain, and that was exciting.
I wasn't looking for brain.
Not yet.
Never. I was writing my novels. I was doing that. What seeing the soul shows, going to the soul shows, seeing the soul shows.
Yeah.
It was just I saw it. Then I started seeing Muddy Waters because they were not anywhere near where I was. And
right.
around the same time, I'd go to see... I drove all night to New York to see Buddy Waters at Hunter College, drove back to go to work in the morning.
Like, what, 65?
It might have been 64, 65. Yeah, he was coming back from the American Folk Blues Festival in Europe.
And with a full band.
With a full band and before his automobile accident and when he does...
Who was it? Little Walter? Who was on
no,
harp?
No, it was James Cotton.
Okay.
And Otis Spann.
Mm-hmm.
And, probably S.P. Leary on drums. I can't remember exactly, but and it was incredible. And he hadn't had his automobile accident. So when he does got my mojo working, he does his jitterbug thing on stage. Mm-hmm. And I think, wow, that's Muddy Waters doing, you know.
Yeah.
But I mean, the point was it had to come to life for me. And that... And, you know, in that same time period, within a couple of years, yeah. all these blues singers like Skip James and Son House and Mississippi John Herd
came out of the wild, wherever they were.
Yeah, yeah. No, they were rediscovered in various places.
And, Skip James, man. That sound is so haunting and so amazing. I read the, it wasn't your book. I don't know why you didn't write it, but The Devil and Skip James? Was that the name
by
of the
Stephen
book?
Called.
Yeah. And it was sort of fascinating to me that so many of these artists sort of just lay dormant for years in a way.
Right,
kind of like, well, because of a new interest, they were kind of found.
Well, they weren't waiting to be found. They weren't, you know, right. It's like, I forget what Mississippi John Hurt was doing down in Avalon, but it was like herding sheep or something.
Right.
That isn't what it was, but it's similar to that.
Right.
And they weren't expecting it at all, but So actually, the first story I ever wrote, I mean, I did not set out to write about music, but yeah. I was so compelled by the power of Skip James's music that I think around 65, and so I was 21 then,
yeah.
I sought him out. I represented myself as being from the magazine Blues Unlimited, and I called up Dick Waterman, who's become a great friend since then, and I said, I'm doing a story for Blues Unlimited. He says, that's funny. They just ran a 7-part series on Skip James.
Whoops.
But I continued. I said, Blues World. I'm doing it for Blues World.
But Blues, it's a magazine. Yeah.
But I mean, I had to drag myself out of the car. I remember parking the car in Cambridge.
Because you were nervous? Yeah.
I was just so scared, and I had a tape recorder with me. My father said, real reporters don't use tape recorders, because he had been the editor of his college newspaper.
Right.
I said, man, real reporters didn't have tape recorders. They hadn't been invented. I wound up leaving the tape recorder in the car because it was one more self-conscious burden to carry in.
Mm-hmm.
And Skip was so gracious to me, and I'm asking these stupid questions. And I wasn't writing for publication. I went to interview him because, in my mind, greatness such as this will not pass my way again. I felt compelled. Two years earlier,
yeah.
I had sought out the English author Henry Green.
Mm-hmm.
I was in England. And he wrote Caught, Back, Blindness, Living, Loving, Doing, yeah. Concluding. Great, great writer.
Yeah.
And I wrote to him, and he said, well, come visit me in some fancy neighborhood in London.
Yeah.
And I did, and I spent about 4 hours with him as he drank the afternoon away.
Yeah.
And it was just so thrilling, and I did, and I wrote up everything. And eventually, years later, I wrote an interview, kind of. But really, I had no business at all except... For the same reason, Skip James, greatness such as this will not.
Well, what did you want to know from him? What did you think you were going
to
get?
It wasn't that. I just wanted to be
around him,
be in his presence. I wanted to hear what he had to say. I wanted to, you know, mm-hmm. in some way get a glimpse, get an insight into, you know, what it was that created or represented this genius.
And what'd you get? What'd you find? What'd you walk away with? What were the answers to that question?
Well, the answer to that question was there are no answers, which I knew going in. But no, for me, it was enthralling. And I would say there hasn't been a single... I've never written about anybody or anything that I didn't love.
Yeah.
I mean, it might be... let's say Merle Haggard to me is the pinnacle of American vernacular music. One of the many pinnacles, but uh-huh. is a pinnacle.
And still at it.
And still at it. Now, I like Merle, but this is not somebody who is likely to be my best friend.
Sure.
And he's a difficult guy. That doesn't diminish him at all in my eye. I'm interested in him as a creative
person.
You'd
probably hang out for a couple hours until you annoyed him.
Well, you know, it's hard to say. I've hung out for him for just a few minutes and annoyed him, and I've hung out for a long time and, you know, hung in there. But, you know, the point is that I knew from the beginning.
Mm-hmm.
You can imagine my body language. Mm-hmm. I'm a person... Now I can talk, and there's a number of reasons I could. Then I couldn't.
Mm-hmm.
And I'm just like, oh, this little, you know. But, you know, I forced myself. I just, you know, forced myself to. And with Merle, what I wasn't interested in, I wasn't interested in the external. I wasn't interested in the persona that's being put out. I was interested in what was behind that. And in talking to Merle, for instance, on the enhanced ebook of Lost Highway, where I've got a chapter on Merle, I included something like 21 or 24 minutes of Merle talking about creativity, about songwriting. That was what interested me. That was what I got from Skip James, who talked about when his father got superannuated, he retired from the ministry.
Yeah.
I mean, I just dug that. But
what does superannuated mean?
Too old.
Oh, okay.
You know, I think at this point I may be superannuated.
No, no, you're jamming. So, like, well, it's interesting how much of that music came from the church at some point. I mean, and how connected it was to the church.
Well, it came from the church and the cotton fields. You know,
yeah.
It was just and the two mixed and it's one of the, I mean, The Fire Next Time really speaks more than anything about the genius not of individual people but of African-American culture and the way in which every moment is prized and every moment has to be prized, and by being thrown back on their own resources, African-Americans created a culture different and some might say superior to the majoritarian culture in which they lived. I mean, that was a very, I don't know if it was an influential book, but it really, it was an exhortatory book that, I mean, to me, it was an exhortatory book that I still assign that to students in the MFA.
Which book?
The Fire Next Time. No more water, The Fire Next Time. Truer words were ne'er spoke. We're seeing the fire right now.
But I think now, like, you know, with this new book, The Man Who Invented Rock and Roll, Sam Phillips, about Sun Records, is like, this was a guy that intuitively, had his fingers on the pulse of that and was the first guy to really, I think, integrate it in mainstream music, no?
No, totally. But, I mean, you've got to understand, he had a vision of what the music was and would be and the force it would have and the changes it would, bring about. He had
From the beginning.
Long before he opened the studio. He saw music, you know, some people say Amor, wink at Omnia, you know, love conquers all. Well, he said music conquers all. And, in fact, he would send music over to, you know, stop wars. He believed that. I mean, he believed metaphorically that music had that power. But
there was, it is magic.
It is. It's absolutely magic. But his vision.
Yeah.
I mean, this is the reason the title, the subtitle, "The Man Who Invented Rock and Roll," should be read the way Sam would say it would be. The man who, quote unquote, invented rock and roll.
Why didn't you put that on there?
I should have,
italicize it.
Well, I've got Sam arguing against the title and for the title in the prologue. But the point is that the reason that I felt that it was apropos in a sense was that he envisioned a music. He envisioned bringing African-American music into the popular marketplace, and he envisioned it conquering, bringing down the walls of segregation. As I say, before he started recording it, that was his vision.
And this is a guy that grew up in the South.
He grew up in the South.
And he knew, like, you know, he was, I would imagine, relatively rare in his views of how society should be.
Relatively rare in his family, who did not like hearing an 8 and 9 year old kid talking about the racial disparities and inequities that existed. I mean, he was working out in the field. His father rented a farm, 323 acre farm, which was really his vision of Eden.
Mm-hmm.
Lost the farm when the Depression came and became a signalman on the bridge, but never lost his love of nature. But Sam, his relatives from Sam's generation spoke. I mean, Sam would say to me, "Now listen, I'm talking about an 8 and 9 year old kid." And what came to convince me that he was speaking of espousing those views was talking to relatives who were not altogether approving. I'm not saying they were prejudiced, but they were not altogether approving of the views that Sam espoused when he was a small child.
Yeah,
and
rebel
he
wasn't
kid. They were later on. Yeah,
yeah. Yeah.
Rebel kid, meek and mild, from a family meek and mild,
yes.
To quote Merle Haggard.
Oh, yeah. So, like, they were probably saying, like, where's this kid getting these ideas? And it was intuitive for him.
He got his ideas from his head. He was
right.
Not interested.
Right.
From the time he was born to the time he died, he was not interested in social acceptance. He said many times, You may not believe this, but I had no personality as a kid. He said, I had the personality of a green persimmon, you know. And his brother Judd, he said, was the one with the personality. He was really charismatic. He could draw anyone to him. He never met a stranger. Sam wasn't interested in that. He was elected president of the junior class, which was his last year in high school because his father died. He was elected president. He was a captain of the band. But he saw it as the outgrowth of his determination, not of his charm, not of his he was not interested in social acceptance.
And it's interesting because you see as he gets older that he sort of takes on this this personality of a prophetic person, person that deserves respect as an elder, almost a mythological character. Sam Phillips is in a way.
Well, I met him in 79.
Yeah.
He was doing no interviews. He had done virtually. He thought that I was the first person who had interviewed him outside of Memphis reporters and the trades.
Uh-huh.
There were two or three others which he had conveniently put aside.
And did he ever, like, he maintained the rights, like, he managed himself well. He was not, did he lose everything and screw everything up at some point?
Well, he had a terrible struggle starting out.
Right, no, ultimately.
But no, ultimately, from his perspective, there was no more record. There was no more opportunity for the independent record label or distributor. And that's why he really left the music business in '60. But he held on, and by the end of the decade, all the independent labels, virtually all of them, were gone. But he held on to song publishing, and he continued in radio, which was his first love. And he saw those as the two viable ways to make a living as an independent business.
Music publishing and radio.
Yes.
Well, yeah, it was kind of, that was right at the time. Music publishing still.
Yeah,
really.
No, and the family still owns the publishing.
Uh-huh.
And no, he was a very canny person in that way. It wasn't his first priority, but his first priority was to put food on the table for his family, which included his deaf deaf-mute Aunt Emma in Florence, his widowed mother until she died in 52 or 51, and his wife and two kids. And he was determined, not whatever happened, he was not going to leave them hungry.
But he started on radio.
Saw it as a...
Understood the power.
Saw it as a vehicle for communication. And in fact, when WSM changed their transmitter in 61, Sam bought the transmitter, and to this day, the family is paying rental on it. They've because he believed it was such an historic thing. It had reached so many people out in the rurals. It had brought so much, including the Grand Ole Opry, but not limited to the Grand Ole Opry, to people all over the country who otherwise would never have the opportunity to hear or know these things. And so he bought it. He tried over the years to give it to the Smithsonian, to the Country Music
Hall
of Fame. No, the
actual transmitter.
But it's too big.
Yeah.
Nobody would take a Country Music Hall of Fame.
No one will
Smithsonian.
Take it. They can't put it in a
He couldn't find any takers, and I've announced at many places looking for somebody who might come up and, you know.
So in a sense that, you know, that Sam Phillips ideologically really laid down some of the foundation for what became the point of view of music in the 60s, the idea that music was some sort of bonding force of all people.
Yeah, an integrating force that broke down categories, you know, not just racial, but all categories. And he was, you know, an unabashed liberal all his life, a label which few people claim anymore.
Yeah, and did he get flack throughout his career from people? Because, you know, you think, it's very easy to think that, you know, outside of, like, the earlier acts, but, you know, those guys, the original crew, you know, Perkins, Lewis, Presley, the guys, the hit makers who, you know, were white acts, you know, there is some sort of idea that maybe there was a rednecky kind of feel to it.
Well, I don't know that there was a rednecky feel. It went back. It varied. For instance, Elvis, you know, as Sam saw him, was the most unprejudiced person he had ever met.
Mm-hmm.
And Elvis, as Sam saw it, fully embraced Sam's ideal of breaking, breaking.
Those were conversations that were had.
No, they were not conversations, but he said Elvis was not the kind of person who would articulate that. And the big thing also about Sam was what he got most of all were insults from the people in the industry. And he was not inclined to...
Insults.
For hanging around with those people.
Black people.
Black people, yeah. For corrupting the youth. This is from people in the music industry. And Nashville, most of all, set itself against him. That for commercial reasons, as much as anything else, they tried to get his records banned from the charts. You know, the records by Elvis, by Jerry Lee Lewis, by Kyle Perkins. And Paul Ackerman, who was one of Sam's... Sam had very few close friends.
Yeah.
Paul Ackerman, Dewey Phillips, his brother-in-law, Jimmy Connolly. But Kemmons Wilson, who started Holiday Inn.
Mm-hmm.
But Paul Ackerman wrote an editorial denouncing the Nashville establishment, the country music establishment, and saying, we're not going to be dictated to here. Paul Ackerman was the editor of Billboard. No, we're not going to be dictated to here. We're going to record what sells, and this is undemocratic, and this is like registering Muslims, and this is like, you know, this is wrong. This is against the tenets of democracy.
So they were fighting a civil rights struggle because of the sort of categorization of the music, because at that point, what you're telling me, that most of this, you know, quote-unquote black music was being played by these white performers.
This wasn't the issue. The issue was that the records that Sam Phillips was putting out were cutting into country music sales.
But they had to draw a line. Because what was the reason? They couldn't say that.
In terms of the Nashville establishment, country music, the line was money.
Okay.
They were losing money.
And they would say that.
They
didn't slander him. They
slandered him as somebody who was violating the classic tenets of, you know,
country music.
Country music, yeah.
Right.
And so you could say it had raised, but the point was Sam encountered direct and angry responses, you know, calling him, you know, a lover of people that he shouldn't be loving.
Right. So let's talk about those, you know, the first recordings in the Black Artist, because I'm a big Howlin' Wolf fan. And I don't think
this is where the soul of man ever dies. How could you not be?
I got a picture of him right there. I love that picture. It's right over the desk there of him on the floor doing his thing.
Yeah, in his older days.
Yeah. So wait, you know, where does Sam? Once he's doing radio, where does he start coming in contact with the?
He doesn't. It's just he can't. Why did he come to Memphis? He came to Memphis because at 16. He insisted that his classmates were driving to Dallas for a revival meeting. He insists that they go by Beale Street on the drive from Florence to Dallas.
Mm.
I don't think there was anybody else in the car who wanted to go to Beale Street. When they're on Beale Street, he says, you know, that his, and this is, you know, a probably less than what it actually was. He says that his friends from high school were amused by the antics or whatever.
Because Beale Street was an outdoor area. I've been there, and there's a lot of music there, a lot of bars.
Well,
at that time
it was Black America's main street.
Okay,
it was all black and every type. I mean, at that time, what you see now is like a movie set.
Yeah, I know.
What
existed
then were
renewed it.
Yeah, exactly. They what do you call it? Urban destruction or whatever.
Yeah, yeah.
But so he's 16 years old. He goes down to Beale Street, and he says, "This was the most inspiring thing I've ever seen. You know, old black men are sitting on the curb, you know, drinking out of a paper bag."
And this is something you can relate to with your experiences as an usher and having those moments.
I guess so, yeah.
Your mind is blown by a culture and a way of life that is outside of you and by a sound that, you know, can't be denied.
Well, he said, it really wasn't the music. He said, "I saw a vision of freedom there because every single person, the young hipsters, the old guys, the people who had saved up for months to come in from the country, every single person was there. Because they wanted to be there. They felt a sense of belonging, and I wish that everybody in America could have that, could see that, the vision of freedom." But so at 16, he decides, "I'm going to live in Memphis someday." And the reason he took the job at WREC in Memphis was not because he was at LAC in Nashville, which was a much bigger station, but because at the age of, he moved to Memphis when he was 22, because he had to be in Memphis.
But let me ask you something. How much of this, you know, in your encounters with him, which I imagine were a lot, I mean, how much, because he seemed like a guy that at some point became very aware of the mythology around him, and he seems like an earnest guy, but did you feel that as you talked to him that there was some myth building of this?
No. There was, I mean, the building, he saw himself in the late, after I first met him in 79, he changed quite a bit. I was telling you, he never had done an interview before in his mind with an external source.
He was just probably defending himself
He didn't want to look back.
Right.
He just thought looking back he wanted to look ahead, and he was back in his first love, radio, and he had lots to do every day. But he was much more soft-spoken when I first met him than he created a public persona as he went out and started doing this. But the persona didn't have to do with a revisionist view of himself.
Mm-hmm.
Almost everything that he said can be found in his correspondence back in 1551, in his public utterances, in his championing when Elvis made it, and all of a sudden he is national. Sam, where he came from, is national news when he's in RCA.
Mm-hmm.
People ask him about what he does, and he says, "Well, man, you should have heard Howlin' Wolf. You should have heard Walter Horton. You should have heard." He always put them in the front, you know. And that wasn't revisionism. What he saw himself as from the time I met him, he created a persona to teach the teachings, to preach the preachings, not to glorify himself, but to preach the
power
sermon
of music.
Of freedom.
Yeah, freedom.
Yeah.
And how did him and Wolf come together?
This is 1951. He had opened the studio in 1950. It's about a year and a half after he opened it.
Who's he recording right out of the gate?
Out of the gate, he had a rough time because he didn't have outreach. He didn't have any way of reaching the black community. Beale Street is right behind the Hotel Peabody,
right,
where the radio station was. But there isn't
the Ducks. I've seen the Ducks.
Yeah, the Ducks were old even then.
Yeah,
but
I stayed there one night.
Yeah,
I did that journey.
Yeah, but it, but you know, Beale Street is like another world, even though it's just one street over. And he went on to Beale. I mean, he was on Beale Street. He bought records for the radio station. But basically, these are two different worlds.
So he's playing. He's playing what they, I guess, they would call. What was it? He was playing black music on his radio station.
No, not at all. No, Dewey Phillips, who was another one of his closest friends.
Yeah,
had the Red Hot and Blue show on WHBQ. Dewey Phillips was playing black music, and that's what tied them together. And he saw Dewey as a brother, and he supported Dewey when Dewey fell on hard times to the end of his life in 1968, and then supported his wife afterwards. But he he's on a high class station in REC in the Hotel Peabody.
Yeah,
he opens a studio on January 2nd, 1950 on Union Avenue. How does he get these great black artists of the South for whom he's opened the studio? He makes that statement contemporaneously. This is, you know, to record some of the great black performers who have no other place to go.
Did he see himself as sort of like Alan Lomax?
No, not at all.
He wasn't there to catalog?
He saw himself totally as Sam Phillips and as somebody whose emphasis was on sound,
right,
whose emphasis was on creating a sound that reflected a reality that was even more real than the reality around you. Just like Ernest Hemingway, creating dialogue.
Yeah, and so, also unheard at the time.
Unheard, totally unheard. I mean, and he believed that once it was heard by a mainstream audience, they would be won over and there would be no turning around. But the first way he started to get, African-American performers to come in was a guy named Joe Hill Lewis, who was a one-man band who played on Beale Street, just wandered in one day early on.
Yeah.
And he said, "What are you doing here?" And Sam explained they were building a studio. And Joe Hill Lewis, who seems to have been quite a I never met him, but he was quite a charming guy. He says, "You know, that's just what Memphis needs, a recording studio." And he went out and he brought in people like Walter Horton and Jack Kelly, some of the earliest people who came in, and then word spread in the community. And people would come out to see this little white guy who they didn't know what the hell he was doing.
but he's recording people.
Yeah. But Wolf, how did he get to Wolf? A friend of his, a guy he knew was engineering over at KWEM in West Memphis, which had a very weak signal at that time, called him up, and somewhat disparagingly, I would say, you know, there's somebody on the station here who has a noon show selling farm implements and advertising his appearances. You know, he plays the kind of music that you like, which to this guy was, so Sam tuned in.
Yeah.
And he said it was a terrible signal, and there's all this crackle and pop. But he said through it all, he heard somebody, he heard a voice, and it led him to say, you know, this is it. This is what I'm looking for. This is where the soul of man never dies. Then he calls up
Wolf. But that was just the Wolf on acoustic guitar, right?
No, he had his band.
He did already?
Willie Johnson on guitar, and a great, great guitarist. Everybody should go out and add to their Willie Johnson collection immediately.
Pre-Hubert.
Way pre-Hubert. Yeah. Hubert saw Wolf on a gig in Parkins, Arkansas, and was standing at the window, and Wolf invited him in. He was about 15 or 16 years old at the time.
Yeah.
So Sam gets in touch with Wolf at the station.
Yeah.
Invites him to come by the studio.
Yeah.
And he doesn't want to put any pressure. It's not a recording session. He just, you know, it's a meet and greet.
Uh-huh.
But Wolf comes in with this Willie Johnson, Willie Steele, sets up, and Sam says, you know, make yourself comfortable. And Sam is in the control room doing, you know, busying himself.
So yeah, yeah.
And he said, all of a sudden, he snaps too. It's just like a sound that is so powerful. I mean, it's like he never heard anything before.
I'm getting excited.
And he comes out into the, onto the floor.
Yeah.
And he gets there and he says, for one of the few times in my life, or maybe I said for one of the few times in his life, he had no idea what to do. He fools around with the mic placement, trying to act like he's in charge, but he's just doing it. He's just so overwhelmed by the music. And that was the setup for his recording Wolf.
Oh, I can't, it must have been just electric, man.
Yeah, no, it was incredible. I mean, the thing about, Sam never saw Wolf perform. I sent him a videotape of that Alan Lomax thing, Devil Got My Woman, which has Wolf performing in this faux juke joint in Newport at the folk festival. But he had no interest in seeing him perform because he said, I had the greatest show on earth in my studio, just watching Wolf sitting in a chair and watching the devastation come over him as he sang a song, watching his total absorption. Sam said, I'll carry that with me.
He's
to the
a
day
big
I
man,
die.
Too.
Yeah, he was about 6'3", maybe. At that point, he was probably weighed about 235, 240
pounds.
So wait,
at Newport, they built a fake juke joint?
Alan Lomax made this little movie, and you have a drunken Son House as Wolf is singing. Wolf knew Son House from way back, and he's waving his arms and talking.
Son House is pre-Wolf.
Pre-Wolf, and Wolf is saying, you know, sit down, old man, don't embarrass yourself. I mean, that's paraphrase.
What was that weird? I had a copy of that video of it was a show done in Germany. Do you know what I'm talking about?
Well, that's the American Folk Blues Festival, I'm sure.
But they set up all those environments.
They had
porches and stuff.
Yes, exactly.
It was kind of disturbing, but like J.B. Lenoir was on there.
Yeah, yeah.
And I think John Lee Hooker, I saw. It was a pretty amazing thing.
Yeah, and I remember Wolf was the most powerful performer I've ever seen. Solomon Burke and Wolf.
Where'd you see Wolf?
I saw Wolf. I just saw him so many times. I saw him in Chicago. I saw him in Boston. I saw him at Club 47. That was probably the first. I saw him at Newport. I saw him in Vermont. I would go anywhere to see Wolf, and I would give up. I'm not a collector in any way. But I bought a lot of records to listen to them. And let's say I have 7,000 records. I'd give every one of them up just for the opportunity to see Wolf one more time. But Sam,
it was a different time zone with Wolf, man. I mean, you know, like even when you listen to him, like the stuff that doesn't necessarily, you know, the sort of rolling blues that doesn't necessarily have a chorus or a turn, like, you know, where, you know, he just moved through that rhythm.
Yeah.
And that rhythm was completely his own, and the vocal power of it all and the way it was mixed, and nothing sounds like him.
His harmonica too. I mean, you know, Wolf was just boom. It was just, I mean, the first time I saw him, I think, was at Club 47, which was in a cellar.
Mm-hmm.
And so they had these posts to hold up the roof.
Mm-hmm.
And Wolf got up against the post and he said, at this point, he's about 300 pounds. 300 pounds.
Oh, really?
300 pounds of heavenly joy, as he said. And he's banging away on the post, you know, would emphasize the thing. And I thought, oh my God, it's Samson and Delilah. You know, if I had my way, I'd tear this building down. I thought the roof was going to come down on our heads.
Oh, that song,
but
dude.
I just never, ever got tired. But the point is with Sam,
yeah,
of all the people he recorded,
yeah,
Wolf was the first he would bring up. From Sam's point of view, and from my point of view too, Wolf was the most profound artist that he ever recorded. Elvis might be the most charismatic. Jerry Lee Lewis was the most purely talented. I mean, he had a superlative for everyone. He loved them all. Johnny Cash, he had enormous. But Wolf was the most profound, along with Charlie Rich, which is really interesting because these are two almost opposites in terms of musical
style.
That's
weird because when I come to Charlie Rich and my knowledge of country music is limited.
Well, so was Charlie's. They put him in country music, and that was the worst thing that ever happened to him, although it was the thing that made him a star.
But yeah, but I think my memory of him, and even after reading, like I read some Tosh stuff too, you know, you two are the guys that I think have showed me some things in terms of your writing. But
now we have different styles.
Yes, you do, of life and of writing. How would you distinguish a style? Well, it seems like you are a historian as well as a guy who wants to
Nick
understand.
Nick is a very good historian. He just has a more emphatic style. I didn't mean to.
Also, he's gunning for the darkness.
Well, he, Nick's theme is there is no there there, and every book says there is no there there.
Yeah.
And my theme, although I tend to believe that probably Nick is right. My theme is I'm looking for the light.
So you're not gonna say that Nick is by saying there's no there there, that is a dark place.
It is dark. I mean, I think Nick would tell you that he's.
Oh, no, I've interviewed him. I've talked to him.
I think he would admit to and proclaim the title of nihilist.
Yeah, yeah. Oh, yeah. No, he would. And
Dino. I mean, how could you top Dino as far as
you? Don't you love that fucking book?
Oh, it's unbelievable. You can say fucking on your show.
Sure.
Because I had lots of things that I tiptoed around there, and you never said, say it, say it, say it.
Okay, the name of the show is What the Fuck?
Well, I know that, but you only see it as the WTF. I didn't know.
Let's say, like, so Charlie Rich, by the time I don't even have a Charlie Rich record, and now you're making me feel like I should, because I have a lot of country, and by the time I'm a kid, Charlie Rich has big hits.
Yeah, Behind Closed Doors, The Most Beautiful Girl, hits on which he didn't play piano and which didn't suit his style, but which sold millions of copies and caused.
But he was an original Sun artist?
He was originally, he was on Philips, which is a subsidiary. But remember, what did stardom lead to for Charlie Rich? It led to him burning the card that announced John Denver as Entertainer of the Year at the nationally telecast country music.
Snapped, huh?
It was his only exit from the life, his only exit from the world. Mm-hmm. I mean, you know, people wanted to say, well, it's because he was stoned, it's because he was drunk, it's because he was this. It really, he needed an escape.
He was done.
Yeah, not done with music. I mean, I made an album with him just before his death called Pictures and Paintings, in which he cut some of the songs he'd been carrying around with him all these years, originals, standards like I Can't Get Started, which he played two or three times a night every week at these.
I don't even know this Charlie Rich, and I really feel like I need to know
well,
this Charlie
listen
Rich.
To, I don't know if you have the two CD set or,
That
three.
You sent, yeah, I got it.
Yeah, and listen to Who Will the Next Fool Be?
So that comes out in collusion, is that the word I want, with the book, that you can get the soundtrack of the book, so to speak?
Yeah, no, it's definitely...
And you should listen to that as you're reading the book?
I don't know that. You should do what you want. But,
no,
you know.
But I think I've done that. But usually if I'm reading a book about one person,
yeah.
I'll inundate myself with the... Like your book about Sam Cooke, you know, turned me on to, you know, that all his gospel stuff. And that shit changed my life.
Yeah, it's incredible, and when you go to live at the at the Shrine,
uh-huh.
that 55 concert, you hear Sam Cooke. You would never hear before, since he not even live at the Harlem.
You know
Square.
Who else loves Sam Cooke? Who I just had in here was Herb Alpert.
Oh well, he worked with Sam.
Yeah,
Cooke,
I know.
Very
and,
early.
And just like to hear
and,
the
he
emotion.
And he and Lou Adler worked together at Keene, and they have the co-write, or I should say, Sam has the co-write on "Wonderful World."
Right.
And really, it was a song they'd written as this little ditzy high school thing.
Yeah.
And Sam saw it as something else.
I love those beautiful moments where like magic is, you know, the alchemy happens, and I think that's really what you're talking about with Sam, mm-hmm. with Phillips in this book, is that alchemy that he somehow managed. You know, by dealing with these artists is really the beginning of rock and roll, and it's not that long ago.
No, and I mean, you think about how Elvis started, and you think about this session.
Did he do Rock at 88 too?
Yeah, he did Rock at 88 before Wolf.
Right.
And why do you talk about taking what you're given? I mean, he's got a song by Jimmy DeBerry where a telephone goes off in the middle, and he says, "You think I was going to, you know, change that for some for some track without that great sounding telephone?" No.
Yeah.
You know, he says you know, and so,
yeah.
And you know, he says, you know, we were sitting there and dump trucks were walking by down in Florence, and he says, "Look at that. That's where it's happening."
Mm-hmm.
Ain't that where it's happening? You know, and he just, so he embraced with Rock at 88. What happens, Ike Turner shows up with his group, the Kings of Rhythm, who renamed Jackie Brenson and his Delta Cats by Sam, much to Ike Turner's high dudgeon.
Yeah.
Because Sam gave Jackie Brenson the vocal. He liked Jackie Brenson's vocals better than Ike, which did not
sit well with Ike.
Right.
Ike did all right, kind
of. Oh, he did all right. And he and Sam ended up good friends. I mean, that was one of the artists that Sam was closest to in his last years. But the point was, they show up at the studio, which they drive by three times because it's a storefront and it looks like a barbershop to me. And they, on their way up from Clarksdale, they get stopped several times for the crime of driving while black. You know,
really?
An old story.
Yeah.
But they also have a flat tire, and when they take the tire out of the trunk, because tires were still in trunks in those days,
mm-hmm.
They drop the amplifier, the guitar amp. And when they get to the studio, they find that the tube is shattered and that there's a buzz in the thing, and they're crestfallen because there isn't time to get another amp. And they just figure they've blown their big opportunity. And Sam listens to it, and he says, "No." He says, "That's original."
Yeah.
Now, that's different. That's going to give you an original sound on the record. And he gets some paper from Ms. Taylor's restaurant next
uh-huh.
door, stuffs it in the amp. And you can hear that buzz all the way through. And that, to Sam, it wasn't that he would have planned it that way, but he was fully prepared to take advantage in, you know, it's like Jack Kerouac, spontaneous Bob prosody.
Well, sure, it's organic and it's authentic by virtue of the fact that you can see it as a problem or you can see it as a gift.
Yeah.
And that, like, you know, like he was intuitive enough to know, like, it doesn't sound bad.
Yeah.
And
no, he thought it sounded great.
Of course.
He thought it sounded great. It sounded different. He blew up. The last session he produced was two songs on John Prine on an album that, Pink Cadillac, that his sons Knox and Jerry were producing.
Mm-hmm.
And on one of them was Saigon, and Sam blew up the guitarist's amp in the echo chamber because he wanted to create the sound of flying fragments of metal flying through the air.
Did he get it?
He got it. And John Prine was so proud of that album that he, for the first and only time in his life, first and last time, he took the album out, once it had been mastered, out to Elektra Asylum, in California, and presented to them in a listening session, and they just looked at him with a worried look, and they said, "Well, John, that's okay, but you're going to have to go back and re-record this whole thing. You know, there's a buzz going through that thing." So it was back to, this is like 29 years later, after Rock at 88, Sam created the distortion, John Prine was so...
But see, like, to me, the whole thing's fascinating. So, like, you know, Rock at 88, for some people, is the first rock and roll song. I mean, categorically, some historians believe that. Do you believe that?
No, I don't think there's a first of any. Nothing.
Come on, Peter.
Give me three songs.
Nothing
comes from nothing. Okay, Frank Stokes, Downtown Blues, 1927. The driving rhythm of that might as well be the first rock and roll song.
Okay.
Big Maceo's, some of Big Maceo's kind of boogie-woogie numbers just...
Okay, so what differentiates that then? Why does somebody decide rock and roll is here? Is that just a branding thing?
Yeah.
Okay.
I mean, the point is, it was Paul Ackerman, probably, who was the first one to, and who was Sam's great champion and Sam's great friend, a guy with a PhD in English literature, maybe just a master's.
Uh-huh.
His specialty was on the 17th, George Herbert and I think the 17th century poets, English poets. No, it couldn't be from a greater difference of background for him than Sam. But, and a very scholarly, erudite guy. Who edited Billboard. And I think he saluted Rocket 88 as the first rock and roll song after rock and roll had to hit.
Oh, so it's a retro.
So it had to be retro because there was no rock and roll at the time. But Sam had this vision of rock and roll. He didn't know how it was going to turn out exactly. He didn't know what, but he knew it was going to be the music that rock and roll turned into, a music that could reach a mass audience.
Okay,
and he believed that Rocket 88, which sold 100,000 copies almost entirely in the black market, it was a huge sale.
Yeah.
He believed it was going to cross over and was quoted in the paper saying that. He told me, and probably other people too, that Howlin' Wolf could have been as big as Elvis Presley with white kids as well as with black. Now, I don't ask me how that could have been. I don't know how it could have been. I don't share that. I didn't, as much as I share Sam's admiration and veneration for Wolf. But that's what he believed. When you listen to some of the driving rhythm numbers that he does on Wolf, he saw that as reaching an audience, the audience of rock and roll.
Well, it's weird because it actually had to go to England and then come back before it actually became
the blues. But he wasn't thinking of it as a blues.
No, I get it.
That was the basis. But the point was, he saw it as becoming the mainstream.
Music.
Getting the mainstream, doing what Elvis and Jerry Lee Lewis, but in the aftermath, the part of his vision was when he realized he could never break that race barrier with his artist, with Little Junior Parker, who could be seen as the birth of rockabilly.
Right.
When you listen to Love My Baby, why didn't this thing make it? It was because Little Junior Parker was black. But it has every element. And he realized at this point, as he was going bankrupt, he realized, the only way I can reach that mass audience, that white audience, is if I can put a white face, find a white man with a Negro sound, but much more important, the Negro feel, and that was when the audience would, once they responded to the music, then the doors would open wide. And that essentially is the story of rock and roll. Once there was the acceptance of a few of these white artists, Elvis first, primarily, then all these great black artists like Ray Charles, Fats Domino, Little Richard, Chuck Berry, Bo Diddley, they came through those doors, you know, at 100 miles an hour, and they became not race stars, not R&B stars, they became pop stars, and they, you know, who went into the Rock and Roll Hall of Fame for the first
time? Right, but most of those guys, you know, still had a little bit of a chip on their shoulder about their treatment and the...
Well,
and,
as they should. I mean,
right.
We live in America.
Yeah, I know. I get what you're saying.
And how do you spell America?
how do you spell it?
Well, I'm not going into the spelling. I leave it to the listener.
So, like, let's talk a little bit about in the time we have here. There's so much to talk about, and obviously, I guess I'm looking for that poetic magic that happened. And you're so thorough, and I don't think you miss it. But I want to know. You know, that moment where, like, in my mind, at Sun Records, all these guys they knew each other. That, Wolf, was hanging out with Elvis and there was...
Not so much, but Wolf and Little Junior Parker especially were inspirations to Elvis, among many others.
But they never crossed paths? They never, there was never a sort of a thank you or show me a lick?
Well, Elvis openly endorsed artists like Bobby Bland, like Little Junior Parker, appeared in the paper, his picture appeared in the paper, then went down to the DIA Goodwill Review, just like I went to the Summer Shower of Stars, the only white in an all-black audience, came out on stage, put his arm around B.B. King and spoke in the white newspapers, in the mainstream newspapers, of how great this music was and how great these people were. So sure, there was a crossover, but not in the sense that they collaborated in the studio.
Why didn't they?
They weren't there at the same time.
It was years later?
It wasn't years later. It was a year later, let's say.
That's it.
Yeah. I mean, it was, and Sam was, you've got to remember, was a one-man operation who, why did Johnny Cash leave Sun? He left it as much as anything because he was jealous of the attention that Sam was giving to Jerry Lee Lewis, who was the hot hand at that moment. If you're one person operating a business in which you're selling millions of records, it's pretty easy to spread yourself too thin, and Sam was not going to do that.
And what was the year span of when all this sort of happened? I mean, how many years, like from what to what was the?
Well, Sam opened up in January of 50. By 1960, he had pretty much extricated himself from the business. He no longer saw the future in many different ways. But you wanted a definitive statement about what? I'm missing your...
No, just that moment where, you know, you can track. If we're not going to go, there's no there. I mean, there was a moment, and I imagine it was the first Elvis hit, that all of it came together and Sam was able to realize his vision.
No, I think he realized his vision with Wolf. I think that Wolf was the living reification, the living visualization of everything that he ever wanted in music. And had he been able to cross Wolf over in the way that this was 51.
So it was out of his hands. He thought that Wolf was the guy and that, you know, what the culture did with it was out of his hands. But in terms
right.
of the sound,
in terms
he
of
was
his own personal thing. But if you want to say, where did Sam turn? See, you said, is it a marketing term or something? What's rock and roll? Listen to That's All Right. What is it that makes that rock and roll? It isn't. You could call it folk music. It's just a
That's
pure
true.
Kind of music,
right.
And putting the name rock and roll on it was the way to sell that music. But if you're looking for what turned Sam's label around, it was the success of Blue Suede Shoes, which he was able to not only record.
Elvis's or Perkins?
Perkins. Mm-hmm. No, Elvis just covered it and actually asked permission to cover it.
But made it a hit again, right?
Not really, no. It was on an EP. I mean, the point is everything Elvis put out
sold.
Was a hit. Carl Perkins, Sam put out Carl Perkins' Blue Suede Shoes at about almost exactly the same time that RCA put out Elvis's first single on RCA, Heartbreak Hotel, which Sam called a morbid mess.
Yeah.
I don't agree, but the public...
What was his reasoning?
It was nihilistic, both in sound and in message. So I don't know, you know, but if Nick had spoken to him about it, he might have had a different view.
I didn't mean to drag Nick into this. We've got light and darkness here, the rock critic.
But the point was that the two of them... Blue Suede Shoes started going up the charts and it made it to the top of the charts of the R&B country and pop, which had never happened before. And Heartbreak Hotel did the same thing within weeks. RCA had lost faith in Elvis because of the explosive success of Carl Perkins, but with the success of Carl Perkins.
But Elvis was at Sun first. I mean, what was it?
But Elvis was a regional star on Sun.
I know, but what was did the relationship between Sam, I mean, how many songs did Sam do with Elvis before he lost Elvis?
He put out five singles, and there were probably another.
Was that acrimonious?
More. No, not at all. No,
okay.
No. When I say he was going broke, he was on the verge of bankruptcy when he sold Elvis's contract. He had been on the verge of bankruptcy ever since he started the label. You know, the worst thing that can happen, if not to a small business, certainly to a small label at that time, is a hit.
And Elvis wanted to go, and he needed the money, so it worked out.
It wasn't really to do with Elvis. It was more to do with what he needed. Elvis wanted to go because of Colonel Parker. But it was, but that was neither here nor there. The real thing was Sam not only would not have survived in business, he would have lost he just would have lost the business altogether. Not the business, but his dream.
Yeah.
And so with the $35,000 that he got for Elvis's contract and with the $5,000 that he got, or that Elvis got as a payout for for the royalties due, which Sam kept scrupulous track of, but he didn't have the money to pay. And with that $35,000 that he got, he was able to reconstitute the company. He was able to promote and put everything he had behind Blue Suede Shoes. And RCA called shortly after when Blue Suede Shoes hit the charts. Steve Scholes at RCA called and said, have we signed the wrong guy in terms of, you know, thinking of Elvis? So, no, people would say to him, did you ever regret? Or some people will say that's the worst business decision in history, which doesn't even rival Lisa Marie selling Graceland for $100 million. But the point is that, no, Sam, it was a great business decision, and Sam never had any regrets at all because it led to everything else he did.
Right. So with that, from there, from Blue Suede Shoes, you get to the Jerry Lee Lewis hits, right?
Yeah. I mean,
Johnny Cash, I Walked the Line.
Yeah, you had Johnny Cash, and you had all these other artists coming in from the beginning, throughout the year of 56, all coming in because they had been so inspired, actually, by Elvis's music. Many of them saw it was performed, the originality.
But I like this, what you said about it, that it could be folk music, because like the thing that keeps pounding through my brain in terms of what we're talking about, your experience, you know, at the beginning with the records you had, and, you know, and talking about Sam Phillips and the belief that, that, you know, there's some sort of alchemy, there's some sort of wild card that could happen that is raw and real, that, you know, because like against Delta 88, you've got Rock Around the Clock, which is an overproduced, almost a big band album.
It was really Western swing.
Right.
And Sam didn't disregard it, but he felt like there's nothing fresh. There's nothing new in it.
But raw. I mean, you know, you got people like Elvis, and you got people like Howlin' Wolf, and you got people like Jerry Lee Lewis, who couldn't help but be painfully alive and in the present with their music.
Hey, look, they're the Dionysian spirit.
That's right.
But and that was what Sam was. Look, when Kyle Perkins would record something.
Yeah.
And,
he was a little tight.
Well, Sam would say, this is, you know, that's great. That's it. You get the feel. And Kyle Perkins would say, I mean, I'll just shorten this, but Kyle would say, but Mr. Phillips, there's a mistake there. I could fix it. Let's do another. And Sam says, no, you've got the feel. And Kyle would say, but I made a bad mistake there.
Yeah.
I made a mistake there. And Sam would say, that's all right, Kyle. That's where we are here at Sun. We're just one big inspired mistake.
but it's sort of funny because, like, even looking at someone like Johnny Cash, in comparison to whatever Johnny's problem was with Jerry Lee Lewis in terms of his success, the difference between them, their songs and their style, is that Johnny was also painfully raw. It was at a different tone.
And totally original. I mean, yeah. Sam saw him in some ways as analogous to Howlin' Wolf. Johnny Cash is nobody he admired more than Johnny Cash, both for his singing, which was, unrepeated. I mean, nobody, inimitable, and for his writing. But the other thing about Johnny Cash is he comes in with two musicians who can barely play, particularly Luther Perkins, the guitarist, and every take they took, because they didn't do splicing, every take they took would be interrupted because Luther Perkins couldn't make the notes. He could play one note at a time, and mm-hmm. He was painfully shy. And at one point, Johnny Cash says, let's do it with another guitarist. And Sam says, no, this is your sound. This is what makes it different. This is what gives it distinction. And it was not the fact that Luther Perkins was incompetent. I mean, he was trying so hard, and he got there eventually, but the fact that this gave them an original sound.
Because he's putting all he's got into the simple notes that he knows.
That's exactly, which is the whole point of anything creative. I mean, that's what I try to do. However simple-minded I may be, I try to put everything I've got into every word I write.
Because that's the beauty of rock music, and I guess that, you know, there's something that comes directly, you know, from the blues, and even, you know, the music that comes from Africa previous to the blues, mm-hmm. is that, you know, it is a simplicity just completely fueled by passion and focus and feeling.
Yeah, no, and yet for Sam, because there were no genres, he could go out and see Charlie Rich, one of the few artists that he would go out. He might go out two or three times a night to see him play on Madison Avenue, and Charlie's playing jazz, which was Charlie's first love, and to Sam, it was the passion with which he played, even though it was not the genre which he would have chosen. And mm-hmm. so I mean, I feel like you can find it. You can find it anywhere. You know, you can find it. And different people have different tastes. I mean, as Solomon said, different strokes for different folks.
But those soul guys, the soul singers, like, you know, like the Sam Cooke thing, is that, you know, what we're talking about, about feeling, really, and about a unique voice, mm-hmm. that, you know, because if you listen to the gospel stuff, I mean, he had a rawness as well, but he had an incredible sort of unique sense of melody.
And of control. But you'll hear it, one of the few times you'll hear on record, some place where he's just going all out and throwing away that control, and that was the underpinning for a great many of the very controlled pop recordings he made.
Right, because ultimately he became a fairly controlled singer, you know, and a controlled pop artist.
Yeah, yeah.
And not, like, it was the opposite of menace. You know, where you get most of the, you know, the Sun guys were menacing in a good way.
Yeah. Well, I mean, you listen to Sonny Burgess. I mean, you listen to the end of Redheaded Woman, which is like a train wreck. And again, Sonny, who's still performing today, I think he's 82 or 83, and he's one of the nicest guys in the world, and he's still rocking. But Sonny just begged Sam to let them redo it. It featured perhaps the only rockabilly trumpet in history.
Oh, yeah.
Sonny's group. But he begged Sam to let them re-record, and Sam said, no, that had the feel. that you, there's no reason to re-record it. You know, it doesn't matter what the mistakes were. It doesn't matter whether the telephone's ringing. That had the feel.
But so you know, what I'm starting to see, you know, even from did you ever listen to those sped up Robert Johnson records? The ones where there's a claim that...
There's a claim. I've talked to people and I've never known anybody.
Did you listen to them?
Well, I don't know what they're talking about exactly. I mean,
that they were recorded at slightly the wrong speed.
Well, that the reissues were put out at a slightly higher speed, which raised Robert Johnson's voice and created an intensity. I've never seen anything to substantiate that, but I don't know.
It's weird to listen to him, though.
Listen to him slow down.
Yeah.
Well, it was a variable. So the point was, phonographs were a variable speed, and there was no true pitch as far as speed went in those days.
I mean, I know it's been sort of discredited, but it is sort of fascinating to listen to it.
Well, it is, and in some ways, you know, it could give you a sense of maybe what listening to Robert Johnson on different days could be.
But the thing that you're chasing, and I think the thing that is not the defining rock and roll as rock and roll, but this kernel of we'll call it light through this music that inspired you early on, that runs through all of it.
It does. It absolutely does. And it took me, that's why I say, it took me to Waylon Jennings. And the reason I say Waylon Jennings is because after Feel Like Going Home came out in 71, I wrote at the end of it. And unless you have a first edition, you won't see it phrased in this quite this way.
Yeah.
But I wrote that
I was
going to say my farewell, to my brief, and I was going to go back just to appreciating the music. I was going to discard the notebook in my hand, which is in my, it's not in my hand right now, it's in my pocket.
Yeah.
And I went back, and for 2 years I didn't write about music because I went and wrote another novel because I felt like I was doing this out of love and I wanted to retain the purity of it.
Right.
I didn't realize then what you mentioned before. I was also in love with the show business aspect of it, and I didn't want to admit that. You know.
Really? So this is the first time you admitted that?
No, I admitted it back in 1973.
not since.
But I'm willing to affirm it on the air. But a guy named Jim Miller, who edited the Rolling Stone Illustrated History of Rock and Roll, became the music editor at the Real Paper. And he said, why don't you write about Waylon Jennings? And I hadn't listened to much. And this was when Honky Tonk Heroes came out. And I listened to that and about 10 other albums.
Yeah.
And I went to see him for a week at the Performance Center, I think, or in Cambridge. And it was like I realized, this is the blues. It's a completely different format. It's a completely different approach. It's different changes. But the rawness of it, just the direct impact of it, and the fact that it's just coming from his gut. Sam would always refer to gut bucket blues.
Mm-hmm.
And I mean, so I wasn't trying to change it into blues, but it had the same appeal. And that's what really, I knew country music. I mean, I'd listened to some country music. I'd listened to Hank Williams. I'd listened to Jimmie Rodgers. But that just totally blew me away.
No kidding. Waylon.
Yeah, Waylon.
It's beautiful. Well, the thing is that sort of blew my mind and sort of got me going. Like, I like to play blues. Like, I play blues, but I don't listen to it as much as I like to play it. I'm a big Peter Green fan, right? I can't shut up about Peter Green. I love Peter Green.
Yeah, yeah.
But what got me, like, I spent a couple of years just trying to sort of decode Captain Beefheart.
Right.
And it's all fucking Wolf, man.
It is.
It's all Wolf. Like the first two, it's all Wolf.
No, it's totally Wolf. And I mean, I appreciated that, but I think there's an abstraction there.
Of course.
That I didn't quite get. But you know who wrote about Peter Green was Elvis Costello in his new book.
I know. I just talked to Elvis Costello.
Yeah, yeah.
Well, that Peter Green inspired him to play guitar. And you used to see him schlepping around, you know, kind of this heavy spirit, man. So when you listen to, do you listen to current music? Is that part of your bag?
Yeah, I listen to a pretty wide variety of music. I mean, I'm influenced by Jake and Nina, my daughter. And
sure.
You know, so I listen to J.D.
McPherson?
Yeah, McPherson. I think he's great.
Yeah.
I listen to...
Well, that makes sense for you.
I listen to Dennis Brennan, who's a great singer-songwriter from Boston. I listen to Colin Linden, who has a great new album out called Rich in Love.
Uh-huh.
There's another guy named Kevin Gordon, who's out of Nashville, who is just the most astonishing storyteller. He does kind of a drone blues that isn't a blues. He was at the Iowa Writers' Workshop and gave it all up to become...
And he really was at the high level there.
His stuff is just amazing. His new album is incredible. I'm totally, you know, there's the saying, first we must kill all the lawyers. Well, it should be amended to first we must kill all the intellectual property lawyers. Because there's no such thing as...
It has to evolve.
Yeah, there's no such thing as originality. I mean, it's good that people endorse Bob Dylan's music, and they say, well, he's like a magpie. But basically, there isn't a single thing that anybody has ever appreciated or listened to that doesn't come from something else.
Well, the thing that like that got me about, you know, sort of understanding Dylan at different points, but certainly early Dylan, you know, after reading his book and then seeing some, and then seeing Ramblin' Jack's Daughter's doc on Ramblin' Jack.
Wasn't that great?
It's great. But, yeah. There had to be a couple of years where Ramblin' Jack was like, oh, fucking Dylan took my shtick. You know, like there was like, you know, he was sort of Dylan was sort of a sponge and a cipher and, you know, and a self-inventor over, you know, these different eras. But at the beginning, the charm and the wit was definitely Ramblin' Jack.
Well, yeah. And I wonder if Ramblin' Jack, I mean, Solomon always said bile will consume you. And I don't see Ramblin' Jack as a bilious kind of person. But maybe you're right. It's just, you know,
Solomon Burke said bile will consume you?
Yeah, this was his advice to both himself and me. Don't let bile consume
That's
you.
That's true, right?
Well, think of certain pop stars who have books out now who have spent the last 40 years worrying about the injustice that was done to them when they were 21.
Yeah. Yeah, I know. I talked to John Fogerty.
I wasn't mentioning any names, you know. But I think
he seems to have gotten back at least half of the publishing rights. He seems okay. He married a nice woman and kind of got him in line, and he seems pretty emotional about it. It's sad about the relationship with his family and his band, but he seems like he got back what was rightfully his.
I'm just saying we could do a whole show on all the ways in which I feel I was done wrong. They were all minuscule ways.
You should start writing the blues, Peter.
But that isn't what the blues is about in a way. The blues, in a sense, is
transcending,
it's uplifting.
No, you're absolutely right. That to characterize it as
it's
sad
not,
music.
Not nihilistic.
It's an anecdote. It's an antidote to sadness and to struggle.
But, you know, it was like, for me, the blues, they were poets like William Carlos Williams. I mean, so much depends on Ray Wheelbarrow. And it's just, to me, it's just, it's what it is. And
I get it, but I think that what Nick was...
I'm not arguing with that.
No, but I think that ultimately, Nick is looking for the heart of that Dionysian thing. And that, you know, his assumption is that, you know, it comes from malcontent, it comes from darkness, and it is a fight against darkness, but it is not moving towards the light.
No, it isn't. But I don't have any quarrel. I mean, he has a great love for the music. But I mean, you could read Hellfire by Nick, which is a great book. But read in Sam Phillips book, read about Jerry Lee. It's a completely different person. Sure. I'm not claiming that I'm right, but I'm just saying it's a different perspective. It's a different angle of perspective.
And what is your take on Jerry Lee in the light?
He's a genius. He's brilliant. He's insightful. He is. He's aware of everything around him except what would benefit Jerry Lee.
Man's got to have his hobbies. So he's his own worst enemy.
He is, but in terms of the music, there has been no greater. And in terms of, you talk to Jerry Lee about life in general, if he doesn't, you know, pull a gun on you or throw you out of the house. I mean, he's always been very nice to me since I met him in 1970. I'm not claiming any great intimacy, but the point is that he has his moods.
Yeah.
But you talk to him about, don't talk to him about world events, but the world around him.
Yeah.
And he's very, very insightful. He's very aware. He's very, in a way that I think nobody has ever given him credit for. And his music doesn't stem from just a purely wild Dionysian impulse. It stems from perception. It stems from, you know, inspiration, and it stems from just this. It's what I tried to, you know, write about Elvis. I mean, everybody just saw him as a pawn, you know, a pawn in the winds. And I wrote about him as a conscious creative artist because he had a drive. He knew what he may not have been able to define what he was going for, but he knew what he wanted.
Yeah. And thanks for doing the work you do. This book, Sam Phillips, The Man Who Invented Rock and Roll. I know we could talk a long time, and I feel a little out of my league in talking about this stuff, but I think we did all right.
You know, I'll tell you what, we should go back and we should overdub all the motherfuckers I left out. I mean, I was being polite.
Next time, Peter.
You know, if you told me welcome to what the fuck, I would have been.
Well,
right
I'm sorry,
with you,
I didn't make it clear that you could let out all the motherfuckers you needed to.
Yeah, no, I had a lot bottled up.
Thanks, Peter.
Thank you.
I love deep music nerds. I want to thank the people who work on the music for this show. Check them all out. DJ Copley at WebPuppy45 on Twitter. Paul Buck on Facebook at Paul Buck Music. And John Montagna, who did our theme music. He's at johnmon.com. JONMON.com.
Go to WTFpod.com for all your WTF Pod needs. Get some justcoffee.coop. Get the WTF one. They give me a little. Somebody was defying me to play some clean guitar. Huh.
Folks, this episode is brought to you by Kleenex Ultra Soft Tissues, your ally to help tackle your allergy symptoms this season. I love the change of seasons, but nobody loves pollen and all those other things floating in the air that make you sneeze during this nice weather. Kleenex Ultra Soft Tissues are hypoallergenic and allergist approved. So fight back against watery eyes and runny noses without worrying about irritating your skin. You know all those times you've heard guests sneeze on the show? Well, actually, you don't hear any of that because we cut the sneezes out when we're editing. But take my word for it, people definitely sneeze in here, and when they do, I've got a box of Kleenex on the table right in front of them so they can use one and get right back to business. And here's what Kleenex means to me: a tissue that will hold up. We've all used those other tissues that you blow holes right through. When I see Kleenex, I know that tissue is up for the job. For this allergy season, grab Kleenex and face allergies head on.